You seem surprised, Lemoyne had said that morning, sitting in the driver's seat, watching Mira take in the scene that filled the field below the paddock where she stood. I mean, yeah, she'd said, rain beating down on her and plastering her hair against her head. She gestured limply at the excavation site. I thought this was still, like, months and months away.
It was, he said. Get in. I have something to tell you.
Can you tell me here? She said.
I can, but I don't want to, he said. Get in.
It's just, I've got a lot of work to do, she said. I want to keep moving.
What's the matter with you? Get in the car.
Nothing's the matter. It's just, Mira, it's raining.
You're soaking wet. Get in.
I'm fine, Mira said. I'm used to it.
What the fuck is wrong with you? He said.
And this time she turned fierce. Oh, let me think, she snapped. What could possibly be happening today to stress me the fuck out? Nope, can't think of anything. Sorry, Robert, drawing a real blank there. The show of temper reassured him.
Get in, he said again.
She glared at him for a second longer, then wrenched open the door and climbed in. What? She said. When Lemoyne had intercepted Rosie DeMarnie's message late on Thursday night, he had decided instantly to cut his losses and give the order to his soldiers to pack out, ending the leeching process prematurely, but salvaging, with luck, the better part of the value of his operation in the park. Yes, he would lose a lot of money in the process, but that was better than losing every cent. Mira was already a liability. The fact that she and Tony had been known to one another, after all, had been a catastrophic oversight on his part. All the more since Tony, together with his roll of film, was still at large. Lemoyne had been hoping he might be able to dispatch Tony quietly, in some innocent and accidental-seeming way. Reading Rosie's message, he saw that this would be impossible, since Tony's death would connect automatically to Mira, and through her, to him. Throwing the death of Owen Darvish into doubt, and calling into question Lemoyne's entire involvement with Burnham Wood, which had turned into a million-dollar hush-up job to boot. There were too many variables in play, Lemoyne had thought, as he deleted Rosie's message, logged into the Korowai comms unit, and given the order, as Lieutenant Colonel Weschler, to strip the site and bring the mission to a close. Has it all become too messy, too multiple? Lemoyne didn't like messy. He didn't like multiple. He liked single, he liked swift, and he liked clean. As far as anyone could prove, Lemoyne was still sitting in his rented house in Tekapo, sending emails, browsing websites, and even making purchases online. In reality, he'd been driven back to Thorndyke late the previous night by one of his bodyguards, hidden under a blanket in the back seat of the dark-tinted SUV. If anything went wrong during the pack-out operation, he wanted the option of denying that he'd been present at the farm at all. And to that end, he'd told the guard to pull into the Thorndyke petrol station, go up to the store, and try the front door. He knew that the station would be closed already, but he wanted to give the CCTV camera a good few seconds look into the car. The guard had taken the deception even further, taking his time coming back, ambling across the forecourt, inspecting the pressure in the tires, even getting out his phone and scrolling through his messages a while. Just a few mindless little actions to make it clear that he was off the clock, and there was nobody else in the car. The guard was good. He was better than good, in fact. He'd been in the house the whole time that Lemoyne had been with Shelley, and she'd never had a clue. You said you had something to tell me, Mira said.
It's about the threat against my life, he said. I found out the guy's name.
Okay, what is it? She said when he didn't go on. He turned to her.
I think you already know, he said.
She scowled at him. Why would you think that?
Because he's a friend of yours, said Lemoyne calmly. Or he used to be.
Recognition dawned across her face. Oh my God, she said. Lemoyne said nothing. But she put her hands up to her temples. Wait, she said. I don't understand. Ever since Lemoyne had seen the footage of Tony taking photographs in Korowai, days before he learned who Tony really was, he'd been looking for a way to ruin him, to destroy his credibility preemptively, just in case those photographs got out. It had taken him until that morning to circumvent the password of the laptop he'd discovered under the passenger seat of what he now knew was Tony's sister's car. And once he'd finally broken in, he'd been rewarded beyond his wildest expectations when he'd discovered, in Tony's recent folder,
a Word document that bore the file name Eat the Rich, created, not incidentally, the morning after the controversial vote at Burnham Wood. Reading it, Lemoyne had laughed out loud. The guy had no credibility to start with. The job was already done.
I don't understand, Mira said.
How?
Lemoyne got out his phone to quote a passage.
These tax-dodging economic parasites, he recited, cannot be allowed to retreat into a private sphere of luxury so well insulated from the lives of ordinary people and so well defended against them as to amount to a form of secession, an obscene evasion of social, moral, and environmental responsibility that would be condemned and likely prosecuted if practiced by any other interest groups or social class.
What is that? Mira said.
Well, I don't know about round here, said Lemoyne, putting his phone back in his pocket. But where I come from, it's called a manifesto.
What? Mira said. You mean, that's Tony's? Tony wrote that.
Yes.
Where did you get it?
I hacked into his laptop.
What? She said. When?
About an hour ago, he said.
An hour ago? She repeated, looking shocked. Why?
Because he's dangerous, and he wants to kill me.
No, he doesn't, Mira said. That's crazy.
How is it crazy?
She was shaking her head. Because, I mean, lots of people on the left write things like that. It's not even, I mean, it's just an opinion, right? It's a point of view.
This manifesto makes it very clear that Tony Gallo thinks that I should not exist.
Yeah, but as a billionaire, right? Not as a human being.
Oh, good. So you've read it then, he said,
trying to catch her out, but she was still shaking her head. Look, I know Tony, she said, and I promise you this does not make sense.
It makes perfect sense, said Lemoyne. He came down here to find me. He knew where I'd be because you told him. He was staking out the farm. My security got nervous. They tried to talk to him. He bolted. People don't run if they've got nothing to hide.
They do if they're scared.
This is a serious situation, Mira. I have the best security on the planet, and they're telling me that this guy is a credible threat.
Mira was quiet. But you don't know where he is, she said at last. He didn't move.
Do you?
To his surprise, she laughed. You just said you had the best security on the planet, she said, shooting him a scornful look. Why would I know something they don't?
Answer the question.
Jesus, Robert, she said. No, I don't fucking know where Tony is. This is crazy. I can't believe this. Everything you're saying to me right now is fucking mental. He studied her. If she was lying, she was lying well.
Has he tried to contact you? He said.
Like when? Like recently?
Since you've been here.
No, she said, not looking at him. And he wouldn't. Like you said, we're not exactly friends anymore, so... He watched her for a moment longer, and then said abruptly,
Okay, let me drive you back.
He reached over his shoulder to put the seatbelt on, and automatically she reached over hers to do the same. And as she moved her body, there came a muffled thunk from inside the thermos she was holding on her lap. Lemoyne glanced at it.
What's in there? He said.
She looked down at the thermos as though she couldn't quite remember what it was. Eventually she said, My phone.
Your phone?
Yeah, she said. I didn't want it to get wet.
Oh, he said.
He released the parking brake and they drove off across the hill. Did she know that putting a phone inside an aluminum flask would block the signal? Of course she did. Everyone knew that, didn't they? Lemoyne kept his eyes straight ahead. Why would she not have simply put the phone in her pocket? Her jacket was waterproof, and she was wearing a zippered fleece underneath it, which would have pockets too. And anyway, it was an iPhone. She had to know that they could handle getting wet. Lemoyne thought about Tony's obfuscation tactics, his insulated clothing, his analog camera, the way he'd timed his escape from the park to coincide with the rain. He thought about the fact that it was raining now. He thought about Mira saying, an hour ago, in a tone of shock. Why had that been the detail that alarmed her? The vignette appeared over the crest of the hill, and Lemoyne slowed to let it pass. But he hardly saw Shelley sitting in the driver's seat, hardly caught the look that passed between the two young women.
hardly noticed as the van went rattling by. A solution was before him. It was so perfect he could hardly believe it hadn't been his endgame all along. He felt as he had in the days after the landslide on the pass, when he'd first dreamed up his survivalist disguise, and he had thrilled in the knowledge that the contingency had delivered him something even better than the plan. For who wouldn't believe this story? A disaffected, sexually frustrated, isolated young man, socially downgraded and rejected from a group he once belonged to, tracks his old friends down to Thorndyke, stalks them as they work, convinces himself that they've betrayed their very nature, and then massacres them all. Who could doubt it? And who could doubt that this malevolent subcreature, this toxic trend, this hateful vector of societal decline would then kill himself, leaving no survivors at the farm, none except Lemoyne, who, as far as anybody knew, was safe in Tekapo, 100 miles away. Burnham Wood was going to prove a better form of camouflage than he had ever dreamed. For after they were dead, after Tony had committed this unspeakable atrocity, he, Lemoyne, would have the perfect reason to terminate the whole construction project and recall all the heavy vehicles, the containers, and the crew. The bunker would never be unloaded, let alone interred. But after such an evil deed, how could it be? Who could blame Lemoyne for wanting never to be near that wretched place again? And who would guess that when the cement mixers and the earth movers and the containers and the trucks and the RVs all left Thorndyke, they would be loaded to the gills with $1 trillion worth of sludge? The precious minerals would leave the country. Lemoyne would put the subdivision up for sale again. He would detonate the site in Kotawai, settle his debts, and fly home. It was single, it was swift, and it was clean. He dropped Mira at the shearing shed and returned to the farmhouse, deciding as he bumped his way across the fields that he would bring his bodyguard on board. He couldn't carry out his plan alone. The mercenaries answered to Lieutenant Colonel Weschler, not to him, and Lemoyne could think of no conceivable reason why Weschler, who had never had any dealings with any members of Burnham Wood, would want or need to be rid of them. Besides, the PMCs had enough on their plates with the packing out in the park. They were already having to extract the stolen minerals in suboptimal conditions and at speed. And Weschler had leaned on them once already. He'd spun the death of Owen Darvish as an accidental security breach that had required a simple cleanup job. He couldn't use that explanation twice. Better to keep them separate. Church and state, thought Lemoyne, smiling slightly as he pulled into the garage, cut the engine, and got out of the car. Anyway, the bodyguard was desperate to see some action. He'd been chafing at the bit for months. And he was good. Lemoyne opened his laptop, transferred a stack of cash into the guard's account, showed him the balance, and promised him 10 times that amount when the job was done. The guy didn't even hesitate.
What do you need?
He said.
I'd rather pay a fine than a fee, Lemoyne had said to Shelley the night before.
This was the maxim that he had held through his entire career. What he might have added was that in most situations, he usually avoided even being fined. He knew that once the rare earth elements were in his hands, no government of any country in the world was really going to care how he had gotten them, and that included New Zealand. Sure, there might be a bit of knuckle-rapping, a few warm words. Tribunals might be formed, activists might strut about, legislation might be passed, politicians might be voted in and out, etc. But so long as there was a phone in everybody's pocket, so long as there was a screen in front of every face, so long as there were batteries and satellites and cameras and GPS, so long as there was avarice, so long as there was loneliness and envy and ambition and boredom and addiction, he, Lemoyne, would be untouchable. The value of the minerals was just too great. What they made possible was just too vast, too important, too desirable. And nothing would incriminate Lemoyne. He would even be hailed as a liberator, the man who bravely faced down China and secured technological independence for the West.
Well, hello, he said, shining the torch into the trees. You must be Tony.
He waited for their eyesight to adjust. Tony was the first to find his voice.
You're going down, you piece of shit, he said. You're going to rot in hell. You're fucking done, you motherfucker. You lose. I know what you're doing out in Kotawai. You and the fucking government, I know it all. I saw the fucking mines. I saw your drones. I saw what you did. I took photos. I sent them all around the world. They're gone. I sent them to every fucking paper I could think of, all around the world. They're being published any minute. You're fucking done, man. You're fucking destroyed, you little bitch.
Lemoyne said nothing. He shone the beam of light down Tony's body, noticing that his arm was in a sling. He was going to have to work with that. A guy with a broken arm couldn't carry out a massacre. Still less with a bolt-action hunting rifle that probably only held 10 rounds. As far as Lemoyne could remember, in the gun locker in the Darvish's garage, there was nothing semi-automatic. He remembered Darvish saying that he didn't own a handgun, nor even any kind of shotgun, as he showed Lemoyne the rack of hunting rifles arranged in order of ascending caliber, most of which were only meant for shooting rabbits, and none of which could be operated with one hand.
"This is getting blown wide open, man," Tony said. "You're going to fucking fry. You're fucking done."
Lemoyne was still thinking about rabbits.
"You need medical attention,"
he said almost absently, taking out his phone to send a text.
"What are you doing?"
Mira said.
"Sending for help," said Lemoyne.
"Don't fucking talk to her," Tony said. "Don't even fucking look at her, you fuck."
Lemoyne ignored him. He sent the message and then put his phone back in his pocket.
"All right," he said. "Let's calm down."
"You killed Owen Darvish," Tony said. "You were in on it together, and then you fucking murdered him, didn't you?"
Lemoyne looked at Mira, who looked away.
"You fucking psychopath," Tony said. "You fucking piece of shit."
"You need to calm down," said Lemoyne.
"Or what? What are you going to do, kill me? What, you're going to kill us both, you little prick, just like Owen Darvish? You're going to run us off the road?"
"Tony," said Lemoyne.
"Look."
He turned the flashlight around and lifted up his shirt to show him his torso and the waistband of his pants, using his free hand to pat his pockets down.
"See? I'm not armed. I have no weapons."
"Fuck you," Tony said. "You lying piece of shit. Fuck you."
"I'm alone," said Lemoyne. "I haven't threatened you. I haven't tried to hurt you. You're the one who is the threat here. You're on my property without permission, in the dark, making God knows what kind of plan to move against me. You're the one cursing me out. The only action I've taken is to send a message to my driver to come and take us all back to the house so you can get some medical attention and we can talk. Okay?"
"Bullshit," Tony said.
He was trembling.
"You're lying. Everything you say is a lie."
Lemoyne shone the light on Mira.
"Mira," he said.
"Would you please don't fucking say her name? I'll fucking kill you," Tony shouted.
But Mira reached out her hand.
"Don't,"
she said, gripping Tony's knee.
"Don't threaten him."
"Good."
She was wavering.
"Listen to me, both of you," said Lemoyne. "Here is the truth. Yes, there is something going on inside the national park, and yes, I am involved. But this is not the deep state conspiracy you think it is. No laws are being broken. This project has top secret applications in defense that are a matter of critical international security. I am fulfilling an entirely legitimate contract in the full knowledge of all the Five Eyes governments, including yours. And you would know this already, Tony, if you hadn't jumped into the river like a fucking lunatic the first time my guys tried to talk to you, okay? You've put me in a very difficult position. I can't let you go because you pose an active threat to my personal safety, and because those photos in your pocket are highly classified images that need to be disposed of securely. If you come down to the house, we can get you some help. I can make a few calls, and I can explain to you, as far as I am able, what is going on here. I did not kill Owen Darvish, as Mira very well knows, and if she has told you otherwise, Tony, then she is the one who is lying to you, not me. I'm not going to hurt you. I have no interest in hurting either of you, but what I am going to do is detain you as peacefully and respectfully as I can, so we can have a conversation and figure out what to do about this incredibly complex and delicate situation we are in. You are badly injured, and quite frankly, you dying on my property is a mess I would rather not clean up, all right? My driver is going to be here in a minute. Just come back with me to the house and talk to me. That's all I'm asking."
"Bullshit,"
Tony said again, but he didn't sound as sure. They heard the engine of the SUV coming up the hill towards them, and Lemoyne waved the flashlight to signal to his driver where they were. The SUV drove up to the trees and stopped. The driver's door opened, but nobody got out.
"I'm going to get in the car now," said Lemoyne. "I suggest you follow."
He shut off the light and walked out of the shelter belt, blinking away the reddish bloom that filled his vision in the sudden dark. His phone was vibrating in his pocket. He took it out and saw that it was Shelley calling. He walked a little further to the edge of Mira's planting site and then answered the call.
"Mira's gone," Shelley said, sounding out of breath. "She said she had a headache and she went to bed, but I just checked and she's not in her tent and her backpack's missing too. And on the app, her location is the same as it was this morning, like it hasn't updated. Like it still says last seen about 11 something this morning and then nothing after that. She must have disabled it. She's never done that before. She's gone. I don't know where she is."
"She's with me," said Lemoyne.
"What?"
Shelley said.
"With you?"
"She was trying to make a run for it," said Lemoyne. "I just caught up with her. I'm going to need to stay with her for a while, I think. Talk her down a bit."
"Is she okay? Like, how is she?"
"She's just scared," he said. "Don't worry, she's not going anywhere, I promise."
"Do you think that I should—"
"No," he said. "Let me handle this."
"Are you sure?"
"I'm sure," he said. "I'm just sorry it means I probably can't see you again tonight."
"Oh," she said. "I guess I didn't realize that was maybe going to happen."
"I've thought about you all day," he said.
"Me too," she said. "I mean you, not me, obviously."
"Can we rain check?"
"Yeah," she said. "Of course. I'm just a bit worried about Mira."
"I am too," he said. "But I don't want to spook her. I just need her to see that everything is fine, and the hard part is behind us now. She'll come around."
"I hope so," Shelley said. "Good luck."
"Oh, Shelley, one more thing."
"Yeah?"
"I want to call a meeting for tomorrow morning, just to draw a line under all of this. Could you round everybody up? Say, 8 o'clock?
She seemed to hesitate. "What kind of meeting?"
"Well, the others are going to find out about Owen Darvish sometime. I was the one who found his body. The longer I wait, the stranger it's going to seem."
"Okay," Shelley said, still sounding doubtful. "But what about Mira? I mean, aren't you worried that she might—"
"She won't be there," said Lemoyne. "I'll leave her at the house."
"But what if she—"
"I have security," he said. "They'll be here. They'll make sure she doesn't leave."
"Yeah, but won't it—"
"Shelley," he said firmly. "She's going to be fine. I know she will. I just don't trust her around other people right now. I don't trust what she might say, what she might do. You know it yourself, she's in a fragile state."
"Yeah," Shelley said. "But how will you explain—"
"I'll tell them the truth," he said. "I'll say that this has been a hell of a lot to take in. She's having a bit of a breakdown, and soon it'll all be absolutely fine."
"Okay," Shelley said. "Okay.
Make sure everybody's there tomorrow. 8 o'clock.
"I will."
"I'll bring breakfast," said Lemoyne.